That's tape roll. I'm Rabbi Robert Marks. Our reading today, our study today, will be of a little-known woman. And I'm going to ask you to help me today because the story of this woman has created a source of personal searching on my part. I'd like to start with my traditional prayer, which I'd like to say when we start to study, Baruch Atah Adonai, Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu La'asot B'divrei Torah. Thank you, God, for giving me strength and allowing us together to study Torah. The Shunammite woman. The two chapters that we will read in studying this beautiful woman and in contrasting her life with the mourning that occurred in another part of the Bible, the two chapters are 2 Kings verses 4, I'm sorry, 2 Kings chapter 4, starting with verse 8, and 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 1 to 24. Now, they're both stories of loss, the loss of a child. I don't know whether anyone else in this room has lost a child, but these two stories, contrasting in very profound ways from one another, both deal with a subject that is very, very painful. And I'm going to ask you to deal with the David story first. So if you will, turn to 2 Samuel, verse 12. 2 Samuel, verse 12. Chapter 12. 2 Samuel, chapter 12. Beginning at the very beginning. And here is the scene. We are talking about David and a child that Bathsheba is about to bear. Him. David, who is the most powerful king that Israel has ever known. David, the king who stretched Israel's boundaries to the greatest extent they'd ever been stretched. David, who fell in love with a woman who was another man's wife. David, sunning himself on the porch of his palace, sees a beautiful lady across the valley. And her name is Bathsheba. And David summons Bathsheba and spends the night with her, and it becomes apparent that she's pregnant. David is very distressed about this. Like Judah before, he doesn't want his own infidelities noted. Remember in the story of Judah and Tamar, how Judah is willing to sacrifice even his signet so that his infidelity with Tamar will not be detected. And so what David does is this. He sends for Bathsheba's husband. Now, I was told that when I described Jezebel yesterday as Betty Davis, that some of the older people, I was criticized because I was speaking only to the older members of this audience. But I want to tell you, I see Bathsheba as a young Betty Davis. Very pretty. And very manipulative. She goes along with all of this stuff and allows David to call her husband and say to Uriah, look, you go back to your house and your wife will be there, and you spend a couple nights at your home, take a furlough, Take all the time you need, in other words, get her pregnant. Only Uriah the Hittite proves to be more faithful than anyone had ever anticipated. And Uriah the Hittite says something like, "Oh my king, I am loyal to you. I am going to sleep at your door, by outside of your door, so that you will be protected from any evil that comes." And David says to himself, "This guy doesn't get it." He says, "Go home." He says, "I'm going to stay here." So what David does is send a letter to his general, to Joab, and he says, "I'm sending you Uriah the Hittite. You put him in the front lines of battle. Whenever you go to battle, put him in the front lines. And if something should happen to him, I'm not going to be terribly upset." Joab gets the message. Uriah is put in... Did somebody say something? Okay, I'm sorry.
He's becoming a spear catcher again.
A spear catcher, beautiful. Uriah is placed in the front lines of the battle, and after a series of forays, very unexpectedly, Uriah the Hittite is slain. He dies. And a messenger comes to David, and Joab says, "Look, if David gets angry, when he gets angry, when you tell him all the losses we've had in the Bible, you just say to him, just sort of matter-of-factly, 'And Uriah the Hittite was one of the people that was killed in the battle,' and you'll be amazed how David improves in good humor." Well, that's what happens. Uriah the Hittite is killed in battle. The report goes back to David. And now, as Laura is about to read for us, we are to see one of the earliest examples of prophecy that ever occurred. Here is Nathan, the prophet. The Nathan, who was one of my heroes. If I ever had to do a course like this again, Nathan would be certainly one of the people I would deal with, because Nathan has the guts to go to King David, and say, "King David, here's the story. Listen to this, David." He says it very calmly. He says, "There are two people, one of whom has flocks and flocks and flocks. He's wealthy. He has cattle and sheep and goats, all that he needs. And there's this one guy, he just has one little lamb, a lamb that he loves, that eats at his table. He sleeps in his bedroom. He loves that little lamb. And David, here's the story that I need your help with," says Nathan. "A visitor comes to see the wealthy man. And the wealthy man needs to fix dinner. And the wealthy man who has flocks and cattle and sheep, he doesn't take one of his own lambs. He goes next door to his poor neighbor and takes the one lamb that that neighbor has and fixes it for the dinner." David says, "That man shall surely die." And here's where Nathan becomes great. "That man is you," to King David. "That man is you." And we could all hear that. You know, we who, any of us who take things that don't belong to us, "That person is you." We can blame other people, but "that person is you." David realizes this. Now, the part that interests us is what happens now. And our reader of the day, if you will proceed to give us an account. And as I have warned your predecessors, many of whom have even survived this encounter and have returned to their homes in peace, I will interrupt thee. Beginning. Chapter 12. Yeah.
"But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, 'There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, But the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. He used to eat of his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one of his own flock.
I think it's interesting that this lamb was like a daughter to him and not a son to him. And I mean that's a very interesting thing, because I'm not making a random comment. As you'll see later, the idea of the son has a special place. And as you remember, those of you who were here in ancient history when I talked about Tamar, the importance of having a son was critically important. But this lamb can't be a son. This lamb is a daughter.
And he was loath to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared that for the guest who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. You shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity." Nathan said to David, "You are the man."
You are the man, Nathan. What guts it took. What good, you know, as long as it was abstract, as long as it was a case law test, you know, Nathan was on secure ground. But now, for the first time, the prophet speaks out, not what the king wants to hear, but the prophet now, for the first time, says what the king doesn't want to hear. That's what makes him a prophet, because he says the word of God. He says, and the word of God is not an establishment word. It is an anti-establishment word. It's the defense of the powerless, of the weak, of those who are least able to protect themselves. Go ahead.
"Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your bosom, and gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added..."
Get this, the house of Israel and Judah, just a little thing that I want you to pick out. There is no house of Israel and of Judah yet. Now, you remember from yesterday how I pointed out that the divisions between Israel and Judah occurred after the death of Solomon. But here we are discovering that David is the master of both sections of Israel. There is still not a division yet. As a matter of fact, it's doubtful whether they were called by those different names yet. It would be like calling the settlers who came to Palestine in 1898 as if they had gone to Israel. There was no Israel until 1948, but still a lot of people do that. And the Bible, reading this history back, says you're the head of both the houses of Israel and of Judah. Israel in the north, Judah in the south, but those divisions don't take place until after the death of Solomon. Go ahead.
"And if that had been too little, I would have added much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised
it." And there is a room. There is a tradition that we all ought to be aware of. That David, who is regarded as the founder of Jerusalem, as the creator of the city of Jerusalem, was ineligible to build the temple, which was built by his son Solomon. And he was ineligible to build the temple because David was a man of war. And war was the antithesis. We had a beautiful peace service last night. War is the antithesis of what the temple should stand for, what the ideal temple should stand for. It is always paradoxical for me to regard the fact that for both of our faiths, for Christianity and for Judaism. David is considered the progenitor of the Messiah. David, this man of war. And I think we have to understand that in order to understand what the Messiah was originally. The original idea of the Messiah was not that of some otherworldly, saintly being who was going to come down from either from heaven or be inspired by something that comes from heaven, but rather was a man who would restore freedom and independence to the state. Now that's hard to accept. Mashiach simply meant anointed one. And who was anointed? The king. The material, physical, powerful, military king was appointed. And it was the king who was going to restore Israel. Why was Jesus executed? I think because he was asked, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" Now that idea of the Messiah, of course, changed later on. It underwent a terrific transition for both Christians and Jews. But the original idea was that of a military leader, so that Jesus, a man of peace certainly, was feared by the Romans, was feared because he might lead a rebellion. He might want to restore the independence of Judea from Roman rule. And that was why the question that Pilate asks of Jesus is so understandable now. What is the question? Art thou the king of the Jews? Are you the king of the Jews? In other words, are you the Messiah? Do you have pretensions to monarchy? And if so, you are very dangerous. You're very dangerous to us, the Romans. You're dangerous to the high priesthood, who at that time, I have to emphasize, were appointees of the Roman government. So they were quislings in this sense. So that the power establishment would be very afraid of anyone who had the name Messiah associated to it. And again, this happens, just to remind you, this happens at Passover time, which Passover time is the time of freedom, the time of liberation. So it's a timely moment, too, in which the king of the Jews would appear. And we Jews look for the Messiah at Passover time. The door is open to Elijah at every Passover Seder. Come in, Elijah, and tell us the Messiah is about to come. In my house, the kids close their eyes and they feel the Messiah kiss. They feel Elijah kissing them with the promise of the future. So here's this vision of David as a man of war. David is the powerful military leader who will not be able to build the temple in Jerusalem. But not only that, here's what's going to happen to him.
I just want to break when Jesus said, when my memory of what Jesus said when he was asked that question.
Thou hast said it.
You said that, yeah.
Well, however you translate it, it is an enigmatic answer, which is fascinating. I mean, a whole series of studies could be based upon the answer, "You have said it, thou hast said it." What does it mean? Is it an affirmation? Is it a denial? Is it something in between?
Is there a parallel with Moses being given a huge job, messed up a little bit, and God says, "You may not enter Canaan, you may not enter the promised land"? David, you've got a huge job, you don't get to build.
That's very good. I think that's very good. So that David can't enter the promised land. You know, I pointed out to you before, Moses is taken out of the Passover Seder because the Passover Seder wanted to keep the promise of a Messiah to come. Moses was not to be regarded as the Messiah. Moses failed. And in all of these biblical stories, as I made the point at my very first lecture this year at Holden Village, that when we read early biblical stories, now I'm not talking about now where it's very clear that they're good or bad or that they've done good or bad things, but the earlier biblical stories, if we look for good characters and bad characters, we're going to be very frustrated. What we ought to look for is the situation. What we ought to see in all of these biblical characters, and indeed in all of life, is people put into dilemma situations and how they, for good or bad, wrestle with those dilemmas, how they deal with them. That's where the Bible, I feel, can become so very helpful to us in helping us see, you know, and sometimes, like all stories, they become exaggerated. They are the exaggerated case, but we still can see in them great lessons for our lives. Yes, I would say there is a parallel.
Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, I will raise up trouble against you from within your own house.
And that will be tomorrow's lesson. Come back for the trouble tomorrow.
And I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this very sun.
And that's tomorrow's lesson too. Because one of the things that because I'm not going to dwell on this, I'll say, one of the things that Absalom does, David's son, is to take over the harem of his father. Okay? So this is an allusion to what's going to happen later on.
For you did it secretly, but I will do this before all of Israel and before the sun. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan said to David, now the Lord has put away your sin, you shall not die. Nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child that is born to you shall die. Then Nathan went to his house.
Now that's it, isn't that, does that trouble any of you? The way it troubles me? David's done something bad, so his kid's going to die? Any one of us who has lost a child is very, very troubled by that. You know, there's enough guilt that we have, and, you know, as I sit in groups with for 25 years, and this is a confession, until I could not do it anymore, I sat weekly with this was my service to them, I sat weekly with a group of parents who had lost a child and would hear their stories. And over and over and over again, parents would blame themselves. There would be, what did I do wrong? What could I have done? And either, sometimes it was an active blame, I let her go in that car with that guy and I knew he was an alcoholic, I should have not let him go out and play by himself. Either there were active things or passive things, things that they had no idea that they had done, but in retrospect, they blamed themselves for not taking some sort of an action that would have prevented this from happening. Ian, I'm sure as an obstetrician, you've seen parents where they've lost a child who blame themselves for something that probably they had no control over. And they continue to do this for years and years and years afterwards. And here's David.
Robert?
Yes.
But if I were going to punish him, I would take away the child. What parent wouldn't give their life to save the child? And by taking the child, the pain of that is a grief that David has to live with for the rest of his life.
Yeah, if you want to punish the parent, you would do that. But you have just given the last line of the last lesson tomorrow. You have just given the last line of it. Okay? No, go ahead.
The Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and it became very ill. David therefore pleaded with God for the child. David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. The elders of his house stood beside him, urging him to rise from the ground, but he would not, nor did he eat food with them. On the seventh day, the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him and he did not listen to us. How then can we tell him the child is dead? He may do himself some harm. But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, he perceived that the child was dead. And David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" They said, "He is dead." Then David rose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. He went into the house of the Lord and worshiped. He then went to his own house, and when he asked, they set food before him, and he ate.
What is this thing? Go ahead. That's what I'm asking. What is this thing? The child's still alive, and he's mourning, and he's fasting, and now the child has died? And what does he do? He asks for good food. What is this thing? Rita, I'll bet I predicted something.
Then his servant said to him, "What is this thing that you have done?"
How did I know that?
You fasted and
wept. It's good to be so prescient, isn't it? 2 sentences ahead. Go ahead.
Maybe you're a prophet. You fasted and wept for the child while it was alive. And when the child died, you rose and ate food. He said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. For I said, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me, and the child may live. But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." Then David consoled his wife Bathsheba and went to her and lay with her. And she bore a son, and he named him Solomon.
Now, can you imagine this? The guy just lost a child. What does he think about sex? I mean, that is unusual. Parents who have lost a child tell me that that's one of the hard things for them to return to. So what David does is, the first thing he does is he goes into Bathsheba, and they have a son called Solomon. What do you think of this morning? What's your reaction to it? You tell me, please. Somebody tell me, what do you think of it? Does it sound right to you?
Well,
how do you feel about it?
First thought is that he's heartless.
That he's heartless.
His second thought is that he's very reality-based. He, the child is gone, and he can't change it, so he's moving on.
He's moving on. What other reactions do you have? And
sounds,
that's a real reaction, okay? That's a real possibility.
He sounds manipulative.
Sounds manipulative?
We're gone around to save his child.
Yeah.
And once that doesn't happen, he gives up on it.
He's trying to manipulate. He's trying to, you know, he's trying to do everything he can to get a result. And when it doesn't happen, his power has not been exercised, so now he's going to go and have sex.
Well, maybe he's going to... God took the one child, but now this one is a legit child according to God's ways, and therefore I'll get the right child and I'll get to keep him.
Yeah. You think that? Okay. I just spilled coffee on my book. On my Bible. Yes?
Before he went to Bathsheba, though, he did go to the house of the Lord to worship.
He did go to worship, yeah. A brief sentence. He went to worship. Like he said his morning prayer, he said his perfunctory prayer. He said, "Thank you, God, for allowing me to have sex," and then he went in. And what was he praying, though? Was he praying that it's okay for him now to terminate his morning and go in and take care of Bathsheba? What else?
He says he worshiped.
What other reactions do you have?
He needed a son.
He needed a son. He wanted to have a son. Okay, you could say that. The power of the son. Yes, Anne.
It seems he's learned nothing.
He's learned nothing. In what way?
Well, from what Nathan predicted, from the whole experience, from the loss, he didn't struggle with it.
Yeah.
All grieving.
Doesn't it strike you as odd? That you know, you could say, as you did, that he was realistic, that he dealt with it beforehand, but I also have to say, isn't this sort of strange that he doesn't have this sense of mourning and loss? What else?
The first stage of mourning is denial,
yeah,
and shock. Mm-hmm. And I guess I feel like it's very dangerous to judge anybody else's mourning cry.
You find it dangerous to judge, huh? Okay.
I wonder if he was corrupted by power so deeply that he lost touch with his humor.
He lost touch with humor. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, all of you said some very good things, and let me say this. I would, and I'm going to address this to you because you said something that I also want to acknowledge and agree with. I find it very, very hard to think of a parent who could just, you know, get up from this loss of a child and go on with his or her life. Okay, just go on with everything as if it were normal. I find that very, in my experience, that's a very unusual thing to do. I would find very few people able to do this. And on the other hand, I do agree with what you have said, that people mourn in all sorts of different ways. You cannot prescribe. And one of the things that people like to do when somebody is mourning is tell them how they ought to feel. That's the worst thing you could do. You know, hug them, hold them, touch them, let them know you understand, but for God's sakes, don't tell them what they ought to feel. You can't do that, because every person mourns in a different way. But here's David, who's mourning in this, what I consider to be an unusual way, a strange way. He's done his mourning ahead of time. Maybe he's realistic. Maybe he sounds like a very practical man. He's done what he can do, and now he's going to go on to do the... Yes, back there.
Well, there's a sense in which it's relief for him.
The child's death.
Yeah, because he's been waiting for the other foot to fall for months.
Well, I've got to tell you something. This biblical story was not written by anyone who'd lost a child. Because you're right. There are people, and I've seen them, you know, rabbis do, as you pastors were here, do consult and confer with and help a lot of people who are facing death issues and helping people who are dying. And we know, as you must know, as you said, that when somebody is ill for a very, very long time, sometimes the actual death is a relief, a release for them and an end of a very, very difficult family period. I have not found this true of the death of a child. I have found with the death of a child that that's one thing that people in our group of people who have lost a child, we have had, we deal with parents who have lost a child. And every once in a while, what I call a ringer comes in. That means somebody who's heard about the group of parents who've lost a child and wants to be there because they've lost somebody else. And once we had a young lady, and I'll never forget this incident, because of the hostility it produced. And she got up in front of the group and she said to these parents, about 30 parents around a table in a room like this, who were in tears and saying they lost their children. And this lady said, this young girl, she was a young 20-year-old, she said, I know how you all feel because I lost my grandmother 2 years ago. And these people were incensed. Now, I'm not for a minute saying the loss of her grandmother wasn't a very painful loss for her. You know, I've lost a dog that I had for 17 years, and I loved the dog, and I mourned the dog. So that what I'm saying is that every loss is a real loss. Every loss is a real loss. But the loss of a child is a different loss, is a special loss. Right. Yes?
I just keep thinking about the times in which this was written, and how many wives or concubines did David have, and how many children did they have, and maybe part of this too. Hearing about one.
One.
And maybe part of it is his relationship to and involvement with all these children.
Okay, that's an interesting comment, and I want to comment this one. I mean, I can understand what you're saying. But do not say to a parent who's lost a child, well, you have other children. I mean, you know, that won't go. You know, that just won't go. Yes?
In my mind, I think of how he mourned Absalom, which was entirely
tomorrow.
Different.
Save it.
I just mean it. No.
When you bring the coffee tomorrow. Tomorrow. That's going to be the contrast. Yes.
Do we have any sense how old the child is? I mean, did it die?
No, we don't. Isn't that interesting? We don't know how the child, not old probably. But that, again, that doesn't make any, you know, obviously the child is not in utero when it's died. It's not neonatal. It's a child that's lived a little bit. But
the point of infant mortality had to be very high, so it died fairly young.
I don't think it's an infant, though. It could be very young. Probably is very young. You're right about that. Maybe this was a callous period where lots of children died all the time. But we know, and from the story we're about to read, that is not always true. Okay, and that's why I had this first, and we better get to it in a minute. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, from what I've heard, if you lose a child, that loss is never felt. It's always
never,
there. And
never.
Even
it's
if
always...
he had another child, yeah, with a, you know, moved on in his life, it still was a hole that
it's always
was
there
being filled.
Well, there's a sense in which he's not moving on because he says, he shall not return to me, but I shall go to him. That's a word of hope.
All right, that's interesting. Okay, you could read it, what verse are you looking at? Let's see.
23. I can't do anything to bring him back, but I can go to him.
Can I bring him back again? Oh, yeah. I think he's saying, if I go to him, will he return? No. He's saying that he won't return. But that's interesting. You could preach on that sermon, and the wonderful part about it is you could give five different sermons about what that passage means. And that would be just wonderful. Now, one more thing, and then, yes?
Well, just quickly, not to diminish a parent's grief, but this one could perhaps be unique in that Nathan had pronounced
and because he knew it was going to happen, you think?
As God's will, yeah, against his own sinfulness, and saw that there was justice been done.
Yeah. I must tell you, I still find it very, very painful, despite all the wise things that some of you have said, that because of what David has done, his child is going to die, because I think each of us are precious in the eyes of God. So I have a problem with that, with the whole idea that David's sins should result in, not in David being punished, but in somebody. There's a beautiful Talmudic passage in which the rabbis, in the middle of a strange, weird passage about pregnancy and what you can eat on Yom Kippur, talk about somebody who tells you to kill somebody else or else you will be killed. And the question is, should you do that? In other words, if you are, somebody has a gun to your head and says you kill so-and-so or else you will be killed, do you do it? And the rabbinic passage is, of course not, because they say, what makes you think that your blood is redder than his blood? In other words, why would David's life be more valuable than the son's life? One more thing, and then we got to get to the Shunammite woman, and that is, where's Bathsheba in this whole thing? She's the mother of the child. Not a word about Bathsheba. What is she feeling? What is she going through? Here's David taking over, and then Bathsheba has to be there, ready for him to have sex with her so she can quickly have another child. Very, very. Now, we're going to contrast that by reading the story of the Shunammite woman, which is also problematic. And this is a painful story, again, for parents who have lost a child. So you're going to help understand this story and maybe provide some insights into the Shunammite woman. Will you please turn now to 2 Kings chapter 4, beginning with verse 8. And this is about Elisha. Now, Elisha is the successor to Elijah. My fourth grade children in religious school never can get them straight. They do not understand the difference between Elijah and Elisha. Elijah is the prophet who confronted Ahab for having stolen Naboth's vineyard. He's the one who, remember yesterday, said, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, even there will dogs lick your blood, who predicted doom for Naboth, which then Micaiah follows through, the prophet Micaiah. Elijah is the one who confronts the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel. with the sacrifices in which the prophets of Baal are destroyed. Elijah is the one who has to flee in the desert and hide in a cave. Elijah is the one, finally, who rides up into heaven in a chariot. Elijah never dies. He's the one biblical character, biblical character in the Hebrew Testament who never dies, which is why Elijah becomes the forerunner of the Messiah. And in the New Testament, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Elijah becomes John the Baptist. And you can see at that wonderful Matthew, Mark, where they go up to the mountain, and there Jesus and the disciples have a summit meeting with Moses and Elijah. And the four of them are together, and that's a marvelous passage for understanding Christian Jewish roots in this early period. They all are together. I think it's Matthew 4, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, they're up in the mountain all together. And Elijah goes to heaven in a chariot of fire, never dies. But before he goes to heaven, he appoints Elisha, S-H, as his successor. And this is one of the things that Elisha does, one of his adventures with a Shunammite woman.
One day, Elisha was passing through Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived and who urged him to have a meal. So whenever he passed that way, he would stop there for a meal.
He knew a good thing. I mean, he knew a good place to get a good meal. He stopped in there every time he would go out of his way. It's worth a detour, he would say, in his little guide to places for good eating. This Shunammite woman, this is a good place to go.
It gets better.
Uh-huh. It gets better, too. Not only does she provide him a meal, but look at this. Holden Village.
She said to her husband, "Look, I am sure that this man who regularly passes our way is a holy man of God. Let us make a small roof chamber with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp so that he can stay there whenever he comes to us."
Motel 88. Stop right here. You know? She's done. She's prepared a room for him. She's got everything. A lamp. She probably had electricity too. Because this is biblical. Yeah, sure.
Motel. Western.
Best Western. This is even better, right?
It's got
Laura says it's better than Motel 8.
Well, it's got walls.
Yeah. Okay. Your
venture was
great. One day when he came there, he went up to the chamber and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite woman."
Now look, we never know her name. She's one of the beautiful women of the Bible, a real powerful lady, as we'll see. A wonderful lady. What is she? Call this Toledo woman that's there.
Yeah.
You know. Call this.
Servant
suite. You know, there's somebody from Falstaff here. Call the Falstaff woman here to me, okay?
And the servant gets a name.
Yeah, and the servant gets a name. The male servant gets a name, but the Shunammite woman is a geography name.
Clark Betty Davis?
No, she's not Betty Davis.
Oh.
This is not Betty Davis. Rita Hayworth. We are speaking to a generation that has passed. I can.
When he called her, she stood before him. He said to him, "Say to her, since you have taken all."
Elisha says to Gehazi.
Oh, okay.
Says, tell her. Okay. See, Elisha is such a holy man. I hate holy people like this. They are really holier than thou. So he says to Gehazi, "You tell her, okay, and listen to what he tells her.
Since you have taken all this trouble for us, what may he done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?" She answered, "I live among my own people."
Okay, marvelous. Is that marvelous? Here's the Elisha saying, you know, anything you want, what do you want? And I love this. There's a little Hasidic story that speaks to me and talks to this woman. And it's the story of a Hasidic or traditional Jews who live in this country today, but they were in Russia and Poland in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the Tsar's horse ran away. It reared, and it ran away. And one of the private soldiers in the army runs after the horse and grabs its reins and pulls the horse down so that it is not terrified, is not bolting. And the Tsar gets off his horse and looks at the young man and he says to him, "You have saved the Tsar's life. You've saved my life. Anything you want, I'll be glad to give to you. Anything, you just ask for it." So this little private thinks for a moment. He says, "You know, Your Majesty," he says, "I have a sergeant who continually beats me up. I mean, every morning he beats me up and he hits me. Could you please ask the sergeant to stop beating me up?" And the Tsar looks at this guy and he picks him up by the chin. He says, "Ask to be a sergeant." But ask to be a sergeant. Because, you know, so often, I guess, the lesson is that we are afraid to ask for the things that are ours. But here is a woman who is just the opposite. Doesn't want anything, who doesn't have any complaints, who says, I live among my people, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to say. I live among my people. Now, what happens? But Elisha has other plans for her.
So he said, "What then may be done for her?" Gehazi answered, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old."
Now, by now, you should know the significance. Whenever somebody says she has no son, there's trouble brewing. And it's going to be deep trouble. Because we know by now the importance of having a son. It is the son that becomes important. It is the son that dies for King David. It is the son that Tamar wants. She needs a son to inherit, to carry on the family name. The son becomes so terribly important. Jacob has 12 sons. Did he have no daughters? He had Dinah. But whenever you hear about Jacob, he had 12 sons. What about Dinah, his daughter? Well, all she did was get raped in that passage that we haven't talked about. But the son becomes so important. So they're going to give her a son. Let's see what happens to this son.
He said, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood at the door. He said, "At this season, in due time, you shall embrace a son."
Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. At this time, in due season, who do you think of?
Sarah.
Who?
Sarah.
Sarah, yeah. The angels. My wife Ruth says, whenever an angel shows up, there's going to be trouble.
She replied, "No, my lord, O man of God, do not deceive your servant." The woman conceived and bore a son at that season in due time, as Elisha had declared to her.
Fifth grader. Go on.
When the child was older, he went out one day to his father among the reapers. He complained to his father, "Oh, my head, my head." The father said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother."
Now here's some father, right? The kid has a brain hemorrhage, and what does he say? Take him to his mother. What a father this guy is. Well, his mother might have been a doctor. We don't know that. I doubt that. At any rate,
he carried him and brought him to his mother, and the child sat on her lap until noon, and he died.
That's sad. That is very, very sad. It's so simple. He died. It's not that he'd been sick for, he said, my head. He had some sort of a cerebral hemorrhage of some kind, evidently, or whatever it was, and he's dead. But listen to what she did. This woman is galvanized into action. Galvanized. She. What did she do?
She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, closed the door on him, and left. Then she called to her husband and said, "Send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys, so that I may quickly go to the man of God and come back again."
And you've got to get the quickness, because in the Hebrew you'll have a, by the clipped sound of the sentences, you know this is urgent stuff that's going on. This woman does not fool around. She's sending to her husband because her husband has to get her the means of transportation. Get me a servant. Get me a donkey. Get me something real quick. And here it goes, real quick. Read it quickly.
He said, "Why go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath." She said, "It will be all right." And then she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, "Urge the animal on.
Do not slacken.
Yeah. Do not hold back from me unless I tell you." So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her coming, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Look, there's the Shunammite woman. Run at once to meet her and say to her, 'Are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right?'" She answered, "It is all right." What?
I don't know. But that's a good question. What does it mean? Because I'll tell you what it is. She doesn't want to tell the servant. She's not going to tell any sick. She's going to go right to this, to the power base, the whole thing. She's not going to tell the servant. She says, "It's all right." She just runs past him. "I'm not going to explain this to you. That's what it means. I'm not going to stop and tell you, you pump head, about what's going on. I want to go see the boss. You've caused me enough trouble, Gehazi. You got me pregnant in the first
When she came to the man of God at the mountain, she caught hold of his feet. Gehazi
caught hold of his feet. And, you know, she threw herself right. She's not gonna let him go. "You aren't gonna go anywhere until you hear my story."
Yeah.
She did everything she could.
Gehazi approached to push her away, but the man of God said, "Let her alone, for she is in bitter distress. The Lord has hidden it from me, and she has not told me." Then she said,
Listen to the bitterness of it. You got to read this. You got to understand this. Go ahead.
"Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, 'Do not mislead me'?
I didn't ask for this kid. But then I had a boy and I loved him." And how often does that happen? You know, you don't expect to get pregnant sometimes. Then you have the child. It changes your life, doesn't it? When you become a parent for the first time, those of you who are parents, when you become a parent, you know, beforehand you have no idea what it's like. And it's changed your life. You're a transformed person. You know what it means to, you'd give your life for this kid. Anything. Go ahead.
He said to Gehazi, "Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet anyone, give no greeting. If anyone greets you, do not answer. And lay my staff on the face of the child." Then the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave without you." So he rose and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the face of the child.
In other words, she's not going to let any substitute, you know, objects do with the work for her. She wants the man himself who's gotten her into all this trouble.
But there was no sound or sign of life. He came back to meet him and told him, "The child has not awakened." When Elisha came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went in and closed the door on the two of them and prayed to the Lord. Then he got up on the bed and lay upon the child, putting his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands, and while he lay bent over him, the flesh of the child became warm.
Some sort of a resuscitation, artificial resuscitation, takes place in miraculous terms. The child becomes warm. Go on.
He got down, walked once to and fro in the room, then got up again and bent over him. The child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite woman." So he called her. And when she came to him, he said, "Take your son." She came and fell at his feet, bowing to the ground, and then she took her son and left.
And in the Hebrew, it is, "And they went out together." And they went out together. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have just a few minutes left. You tell me why, 2 things. Why the people that I try to counsel find this story so terribly, terribly disturbing, and why by the time I get through talking with them about it, I find it, and some of them find it, very, very comforting. The disturbing part first. Why would you find it disturbing? What is there in this story?
That you brought back this child. Why not mine?
Why not mine, right?
Did I do enough?
Did I do enough? Okay, what else? What else do you see here? What else do you see here?
No reason for him to die.
There's no reason for him to die. What else? Do you see anything else?
Didn't pray right.
He didn't pray right. She didn't pray right?
Well, I mean, Elijah had the right form.
Yeah. Elijah had the right form. What?
Like,
what
else? We have a father who doesn't seem to care.
The father is totally out of this thing, isn't he? He doesn't seem involved at all. You know, what kind of a father was he? Is always another sort of a lecture. What else do you see in here? What else do you see in here? The parents find it so disturbing because they've lost a child. And they know that the child is not coming back to life. They know that whatever they do, they can run to anybody they want to. And some of them have done this. They cannot believe the child is gone. They can't believe. Facing that is an impossibly painful thing. And in their minds, for months afterwards, they relive a different scenario. They have dreams in which there are different scenarios, different. They talk to their child in their dreams. And then they wake up and they say, "I can't talk to Samuel. I can't talk to Debbie. I can't do it. She's gone." And they read this story, and here's a child that comes back to life. And they know that's impossible. And they get very, very angry. And I read it in a different way, and the different way is maybe some of you can imagine it, but maybe not. Anybody want to try? Anybody have any thoughts about how this story could be comforting? Think for a moment. In other words, for you, for all of you, it would not be a comforting story. In anyway.
Well, there's a chance for resuscitation.
There is a chance for an actual resuscitation, yeah. But it doesn't happen.
They went out together at some point.
Hold that, okay? Yeah. What do you want to say, Ann?
I'm just thinking, the birds are souls go in eternity, that there will be a joining.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Good, thank you. Yes? Well, the idea, the hope of resuscitation is certainly there, but very seldom. But it's the passage you picked that I find so comforting, and you've alluded to it. It's that last sentence in this beautiful story of a woman who was so hospitable and so generous, who asked for nothing, who was given a son that was the pride of her life, had the son taken away. In other words, this woman has gone through all the agonies that anybody could ever go through. And the very last sentence of the story, give me one moment, okay? The very last sentence of the story is, "And they went out together." They went out together. And I'm saying that this story for me transcends the death itself. That if you really love somebody, and it doesn't need to be a son or a daughter, it doesn't need to be a child, it could be a husband, a wife, a brother, or a sister. If you really love somebody, they went out together, You carry the person with you, even though gone. The memories never, never fade, never die. You're always together. And the two of them walked off together. And to me, it's so beautiful. Thank you very much. Chapter 13, and then one more. 2 Samuel chapter 13. Let me write it down too. And the other one we're going to read and do it. Okay, but we're going to read section, and I'll interrupt it, you know. It won't bother, you know. You won't feel so bad. Okay, God bless you. Let me just pray. Those two chapters are going to be that.
Okay.
That'll be the end. I spilled my coffee. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do what you just did. And once you ruin a handkerchief.
Excuse me, if you were to die, would you like to try to...
No, I don't.
So you made a full day.
Well, then, no, I didn't do 6 o'clock. I was leaving. I ran down here to do this.
Everyone is good in this spot.
Okay,
A 10.5 is the one.
I thought I knew what direction it was going, and then it never did that.
The top right noon. Did you ever come out? I don't know. I feel like I should almost go to the height.
Wait, they're kind of break at 10.
Didn't tell me that.
It's 10:30.
And then I'm going to go to this one of the home from Olson.
She was just here.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to...
And then there's this problem that I'm going
to... ...the restroom to the bookstore.
Five or 6:15. Mm-hmm. Now, one part of me said maybe I should do 6:15 because I know where the
twins are doing. Twins.
And I just
come
in afterwards.
Where are they?
I guess they're daily.
No, I don't. I haven't looked at them yet.
Of course, they're last year's papers.
And your main concern is how the twins are doing. You don't care about the world falling apart.
I don't care about the world.
These twins.
You go check the laundry.
Okay.
Reminds me of when I first started teaching in a Lutheran school years and years and years ago. And it was out in the country, and we had women, mothers. Well, we had one head cook, but then we had mothers that were required to come in. As you were listed, you either came or got somebody. And then we had wonderful head cook meals. And I came down there one time, and all these ladies were standing around, and they were almost in tears about somebody who got sick or died and all this stuff. And I said, "Who is this?" Well, it was one of the soap operas.
They were so involved.
I mean, I was just out of college, and I was like, "What's wrong with these ladies here?"
Oh, well.
But they were really